Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Talk of Gaslane Alley on 1070 The Fan. We had a very busy day today. I think 35 car driver combinations were on the track. No incidents, and we'll give you a rundown on speeds a little bit later in the program. But we've already got callers hanging on. 239-1070 is the number to call for the next hour or so, about 55 minutes. 239-1070, and let's go straight to the phones. And Larry, you're first up. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Donald.
How are you?
Fine. Could you profile the 1946 winner, George Robeson?
Sure.
And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. He was born in England. And came he and there were some sisters, and he had a brother, Hal, who also drove. And they came to Canada, and then I think they went back to England and then returned again and ended up in Southern California, I believe Southgate. And so George started racing probably about 33 or 34 dirt tracks in the southern Los Angeles. They had a track called Southern Ascot, which was a different track from Legion Ascot Speedway. I think it was Southgate is where that was. Anyway, the first time that he came to the Speedway was in 1939, and he Deacon Litz owned an Alfa Romeo, but he drove a Maserati for somebody else, and he qualified, but George Robeson, who actually completed a fallout qualifying run and was temporarily in the field, got bumped out, and he was the first alternate starter in his first year. But he did drive relief for Frank Briscoe and ran a few laps. That car finished 20th, and there were two other relief drivers in that as well, Harry McQuinn and Al Putnam. And then in 1940... In 1940, he drove for the Hughes Brothers of Denver, who had purchased one of the 1935 Ford V8 Millers, and that actually was his first start, and that one dropped out. And then in 1941, he drove for Leon DeRay in a Gilmore-sponsored car. That also dropped out, but he drove relief for Tommy Hinnerschitz with the Mark Special out of Gary, Indiana, and finished 10th. Then came the war years, and in 1946 he was entered in a car that was actually 8 years old, Thorn Engineering Special, Art Sparks, built by Clyde Adams, Clyde Adams Body. And he qualified, I think, for the fifth row, and going into the race, I don't think anybody really thought of him as a potential winner. I really think that they probably figured that he was like a fifth, sixth place contender, but it wasn't long before Kerr started dropping out, and he was in a commanding position, and I think he led like 138 of the 200 laps to win the 1946 Indianapolis 500. He then had quite a bit of success in a short time thereafter. He won a sprint race at Columbus, Ohio at a new track called Powell Speedway, and he won a sprint race at Langhorne. And he was right before the war, you had several incidents of where a driver, Wilbur Shaw, for instance, was now to the point where all he was running was the 500. And George Robeson said he would be a racing champion, and he was offered all kinds of deals. So his idea was to run as many races as he could and get appearance money. And unfortunately, in 1946, on September the 2nd at Atlanta, Georgia, the 1 mile dirt track, Lakewood Park Speedway, there was an accident right at the very end of the race. They only had just a couple of laps to go, and there was dust and cars crashing everywhere, and nobody could see where they were going. And he and George Barringer, another Indianapolis 500 driver, were both fatally injured, and they were both driving winning cars. George Barringer was in what had been Wilbur Shaw's pay car, the Gilmore Special, that won the race in 1937. And George Robeson was in the 1938 Floyd Roberts winner, which had crashed in 1939 and taken the life of Roberts. And so it's just a little bizarre note, and I probably didn't even need to bring this up, but Cliff Brashear owned the car, and Floyd Roberts and George Robson, two Indianapolis winners, were both fatally injured in the same car. And apparently, that car was torched after the race. I mean, it was badly damaged, but apparently Cliff Brashear just torched it and just had it dismantled because he didn't want it to hurt any other driver. Anyway, George Robson was born in Newcastle on Tyne, if I didn't say that, and there's kind of a little trivia there. Although he was born in England, if you look at Newcastle upon Tyne on the map, it's very, very close to the Scottish border. And so George Robson and Jim Clark were raised just a very short distance from each other, although, of course, Clark was Scottish and Robson was English. He had a brother, as I say, Hal Robson, who ran in 46, 47, and 48. So Hal continued on after George was fatally injured. And George Robson is one of several winners who won the race while they had a brother in the starting lineup. Anyway, thank you for asking about him, because not a lot is known. He has a few relatives around, but it's a name you don't hear very often. And the popular pronunciation was Robson. But when I came over here, I mean, I'd always been calling it Robson, and so when I met Hal, the brother, I said, "What is the correct pronunciation of your name?" He said, "Robson." He said, "They just always called us Robson." He said, "You know, and it should have an E in it to make it Robson." But he said, "We used to go up and tell the announcers, and we just finally gave up." But anyway, thanks very much indeed for that call. 239-1070 is the number to call. We got Paul from Racine on the phone, and Paul, good evening. They ran all day today.
Yeah, how about that? What a novel concept.
Yeah, they ran 2,628 laps today.
And well, I figured as soon as it dried out, they were going to be busy, and I suspect that'll be the way the rest of the week. So.
Well, it's. I mean, it didn't look like they were going to be able to run this morning. I mean, it looked like it was going to pour with rain all around the track, but it held off. I don't know that there was even a yellow for even spotting. I don't know. If there was, it certainly wasn't for very long. So, as I say, they turned 2,628 laps, and there was 35 car driver combos. The speeds were down a little bit because it was windy. 223.7 was Ryan Briscoe, and I think that was his prime car, and I think Kestra Neves was right behind him, and I think that was the backup car. But I assume that they were running fuel tests. Apparently, Frank Briscoe was a T car as well, apparently.
So Team Penske is firing back, huh?
Yeah. Anyway, what would you like to hear about, Paul?
Well, I'm going to fast forward to the 70s. Can you talk a little bit about Larry Boom Boom Cannon?
Yeah, sure.
I love that name.
Okay, yeah, Larry Cannon was from Danville, Illinois, and actually Oakwood. And he was a politician after he was... I'm not sure if he was still running in the race because he continued on till 84. His last stat was 80. But he was the recorder of deeds for Vermilion County, and he ran for other offices as well that he didn't get. But anyway, there's a little trivia about him, and I'll get to that in a moment. He was a super modified driver, and I think it was in 1968 or 69... At Eldora Speedway, they had a 500-lap sprint car race. 500 laps. It went on forever. Anyway, he won that and had a problem. It's the only one I ever went to, and probably about 10 laps, 12 laps to go, they started to have a problem. And he had smoke pouring all out of it, the thing, but he just kept on going and won the race. Anyway, his first year at the Speedway was 1970. And it was an incomplete test. 71, I think, was an incomplete test. And then I think it was 73 before he passed the test. 72, I don't think he was entered. Anyway, his first start was 1974 for the Hoffman family of Loveland, Ohio. The American Financial Corporation Special. And it was an older Eagle that had been modified slightly. So he did a great job qualifying that car. Did not finish, and he finished 24th. In 75, he didn't make it. 76, he did. They had a new eagle, or a newer eagle, and that was race was stopped at 102 laps because of rain, and he was flagged off 17th. And then in 77, he did not make it, but he drove as relief, and he's the last person that actually drove relief. Now, there was a driver switch in 2004 when there was a rain delay during the race, and Robbie Gordon was obliged to leave to go down to Charlotte, and so Jacques Lozier took over and drove the second half of the race. But that was prearranged, and during the downtime, they had the opportunity to change the seats and everything. But in 77, they weren't doing that, and there hadn't been any relief jobs for a while. But John Mailer became worn out driving Don Murgard's Eagle, and so they brought him in, and Larry Cannon got in, and there's a little bit of a story there. But when he finally got out, he ran eight laps before the checkered flag came out, and he was very proud of the fact that he was actually on the track. He was one of the few drivers that could say that they were on the track when A.J. Foyt won his fourth 500. And then he missed it in 78 and 79, and then 80. It was a small operation, but he introduced Krako car stereos to the speedway. It wasn't like before other car owners were able to whisk that away, but Krako's first experience at the speedway was with Larry Boom Boom Cannon, and he had a problem right at the start, mechanical, and I think he had in two laps, and he finished 33rd. And then in 81, he got bumped, and then in 82, 83, 84, he never even went to the qualifying line. But anyway, I'm going to wrap this one up here, but there is a little bit of trivia about it, and we will quickly review his starts and see if you can note the trend. He was 24th in 74, 17th in 76, and 33rd in 80. It's to do with the years that he started. Every time that Larry Cannon started the race, Johnny Rutherford won. And he knew that, but Rutherford didn't. But anyway, we got plenty more of this, and we'll be here until 7, and then we continue on for another hour after that with the Network Indiana version of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. You're listening to the 1070 The Fan version, and we will just take the break, and we'll be back in a few moments with more of the Talk of Gasoline Alley.
In 1951, Harry Hart talked with us and brought along a friend. Harry had come in second three times in the 500. His friend had won it. Here's the conversation.
Thank you very much. That's very nice of you. And I've enjoyed the work very much. We put 17 new drivers through this year, and one more up on his 120-mile arm. But it's been a lot of fun, and I enjoy working with these youngsters. I call them youngsters, you know, because they're young drivers. I'm just trying to familiarize them with the differences of this big speedway, because they're going a lot faster than they ever gone in their life before. And this BorgWarner, and this part of BorgWarner and Studebaker are all together. And Sid, you're too young, but here's Billy Arnold, who won the race for me in 1930. I think you know Billy Arnold.
Well, you know, Harry, this is the man that I saw win the very first time I saw a race here at Indianapolis.
Oh, did you really?
Billy Arnold in 1930. He had the pole car that year, didn't you, Billy?
Yes, he certainly did, I said. And he took the lead on the second lap and led for the entire 500 miles, which had never been done before or since. And back in 1930, he won $52,100. And that purse was not equal until last year when Johnny Parson won $57,700. And that, and Billy's win was before the days of income tax.
Well, he could keep it then, and he looks very prosperous here tonight. Where's the hometown now, Billy Arnold?
Well, I spend half my time in Texas, San Antonio, and the other half up in Oklahoma City.
How long has it been since you visited us here in Indianapolis for the 500?
Well, the last time I was here, Ray, was in 1947.
1947. That's You've been right. away for too long a time. The folks have missed you around this part of the country.
Incidentally, this is only the third time I've been back since I quit racing in 1932.
Do you attempt to cover some of the races down in your part of the country when you have a chance?
Every one of them.
You still have that love for racing, don't
That's
you?
That's right.
Thank you, Billy Arnold.
Billy Arnold, the 1930 500 winner, for that conversation, along with Harry Hartz back in 1951. This is Sid Collins reporting on another 30 Days in May.
We're back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and I forgot to warn you that one was coming up. At least I didn't know which take it was going to be. Actually, the other night, I happened to get up in the middle of the night for some reason, and it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, well, I'll just flip on the TV and see what's on Turner Movie Classics. and the crowd roars was on. And so shortly after I tuned in, they had the segment where James Kegney comes back to the track as a down and out after having been a leading driver and had a reversal of fortune. And he goes into what's supposed to be the pits at Indianapolis, but it was actually Legion Ascot Speedway. And several drivers play themselves, including Harry Hurts. Shorty Cantlin has a very brief, I think he says, "Hello, Joe." And then Spider Matlock is in the shot. And then he has a conversation with Fred Frame. And then he has a conversation with Billy Arnold. And they were all did a pretty good job. And Billy Arnold especially was a pretty good actor, considering that he had, you know, no training as far as I know. And then just a few minutes later, there's like an inside joke where he goes to what's supposed to be Tom Beale's Diner, which was the restaurant, with an open-sided restaurant that they had in the garage area with wooden stools, and that was the hangout for everybody. So they've replicated that in the movie, although obviously it's a studio job. And the fellow that's supposed to be Tom Beale has got a chalkboard, and he's written up the odds for the coming race. And I think he's got Billy Arnold first and Bill Cummings second and then Louis Meyer third. And there's a fellow sitting with his back to the camera, and this was shot in the winter of 31. And he says, "How come you haven't got me up there, Tom?" And he says, "Well, you know, when you're good and ready, I'll put your name up there too." And then you see the shot of who he's been talking to, and it was Louis Schneider. Now, there's no explanation, but Louis Schneider had just won the 500 that year, so it's just kind of an inside joke. Anyway, didn't mean to go on so long for that, but it's great to hear those voices. And there is a Sid Collins vignette right after the 6:15 break every night. Anyway, we do have some speeds for you, but we've also got callers, so let's go to the phones and go to John. Thanks for calling in. Good evening, John.
Thank you. My question is, when did the term bonsai run first get used to describe a bonsai run?
Oh, that's a good question. I've never been asked that before. It was used in the... Golly, I would say... I don't know if that was used in the 60s or not. I know exactly what it means, and I know several people that have done them, but that's a very good question. I don't know when that would have first been used. I don't think that's a 50s term. I'll have to ask some old-timers. Just like another one of those things where it kind of came in and nobody wrote it down, like bubble or bumped. In terms like that, which we think we've been able to track down a little bit, and then rookie is another one. But anyway, no, I don't know. I'll try to find out, and thank you for asking that.
And who was the last person to successfully qualify with a bonsai run?
Well, the last person to do that? Probably.
Boney had practice before he went out.
That's true. But exactly what a bonsai run is, I mean, Randy Lewis did one every year. And Bob Harkey, Johnny Parsons, John Mailer all had a reputation for doing bonsai runs. I don't know if George Snyder would be considered that, because he was usually the last qualified, but very smooth. To me, a bonsai is one where you are just hanging it out and, you know, slipping and sliding all over the place. And nobody really does that anymore. But Randy Lewis did, so I'd almost think it was him. So I guess I'm not giving you very good answers, because I don't think there is one. It's all interpretation. Okay, John? All right, well, thank you very much indeed, and let's go back to Steve. You're up. Good evening.
Good evening, Donald. It's Steve, the old tire guy, with my annual question. I was just wondering if you could tell everyone about our old friend Billy DeVore, a pretty colorful character. I'll hang up and listen to your comments and just continue to enjoy the show.
All right. I'll be happy to talk about Billy DeVore, but we're not even going to really have a chance to get started on this, because we do have to take a break. But thanks to everybody for calling. And We've got another half hour to go when we come back. The number to call will be 239-1070, 239-1070. And when we come back, we'll give you the speeds for the day, because some of you may be interested in that. There was 35 driver-car combinations, so we'll give you the top 10, and then we'll talk about Billy DeVore when we return. You are listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. We're back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan, and we're going to talk about Billy DeVore in just a few moments, but we probably ought to update you on the speeds for those of you that may have just joined us and wonder what happened today. There were 35 car driver combinations that turned 2,628 laps. There were no incidents, and I'm not even sure if... I know they went yellow several times, but... toe-ins and so on and so forth. I don't know that it looked like it was going to spit with rain a couple of times, but I don't know that they ever stopped because of that. But anyway, Ryan Briscoe and Elio Castroneves with their backup cars and presumably running fuel tests, race day setups, were the fastest. Briscoe at 223.7 and Castroneves at 223.2, and then Scott Dixon was next at 223.1. And going from 4th to 10th, from 222.8 down to 222.3, were Tony Kanaan, Thomas Scheckter, Will Power, fastest rookie, John Andretti, comeback of the year, Hideki Muto, Dan Weldon, and Bruno Junqueira. And I have to say, the real surprise this month is John Andretti with very few laps. In fact, he got up to... the first day he was in the car was on Saturday, the first qualifying day, and he did three laps and got to 220. And so here he is running seventh, and there was a lot of running today. Anyway, Steve called and asked about Billy DeVore, and we didn't look it up on Wikipedia during the break. It's just that we needed to take one. And in fact, we were talking with Robbie Buell during the break, and that's a good time as any to thank Robbie Buell and Dennis Reinbold for allowing us to be in their garage. If you could hear some talking in the background, actually there was part of the debriefing going on, and all three drivers were here, and two have left, and we've got one still remaining here. Anyway, Billy DeVore is a footnote in history because he is the first second-generation driver to drive in the 500. His father, Earl DeVore, drove in 1925-27 when he finished second, and 28. Earl DeVore and Norman Batten went down on the SS Vestris shipping disaster in November of 1928. At the end of the season, they were on their way to South America to race their Millers during the winter, and both drivers were lost, and I think all of the equipment was lost, but the two ladies both survived. But Billy, I have to figure out what age he would have been at that time, but probably 11, 12, 13 years old, I think. Well, no, he would be more than that. He would be more than that because he was a riding mechanic in 31, so he had to be more than that. But anyway, he was a riding mechanic in 31, and I don't know if I can remember all of these. Deacon Litz in 31, and then 33, he was second. He actually rode with Wilbur Shaw to second place with the Mallory Special, owned by Leon Duray. And searching my mind for... I think he was with Doc McKenzie to ninth in 1935, but I might be wrong on that one. But anyway, he did ride in all of those years from 31 to 35. In 36, he was an entered driver and actually ran some practice laps very early in the month for Babe Stapp, the Wheeler Special. And he went to Atlanta and got hurt down there, so he was knocked out for the rest of May. In 1937, he finished seventh in a car that was it was partially owned by James E. Wynn, who was better known as Billy Wynn, and went 163 laps, I think it was, before he took relief from Fred Frame, 1932 winner. And Fred Frame finished the race in seventh place. Billy DeVore normally would qualify near the back and run very steadily. So seventh with relief from Fred Frame was his best finish. He was 8th in 38. He was 10th in 39 with driving for Leon Duray with Henry Banks as a relief driver. And then he was 18th in 40 with the Bill Hollabird's Ridge Center Tennessee Special. And then he was 19th in 41 with the Hollywood Payday Candy Bear Special. Love those car names. In 46, he drove the Shoof Special and dropped out very near the end and actually had more laps than the ninth place finisher because the attrition rate was high. But in 46, they were still going with the rule that cars running at the end would be ranked ahead of those that dropped out. So he had 167 laps in, I think, when he had his mechanical problem, but he ended up 10th. In 47, he did not qualify, and that was for Bill Shoof, the same person that he drove for in 46. But he co-drove for his teammate, Duke Dinsmore, Carlisle Duke Dinsmore, and they shared the car to 10th place. And then the final start, although he was running as late as 53 trying to qualify, his last start was 1948 with a famous car, the Pat Clancy Special, which was very famous because it had six wheels. Pat Clancy was had been a dirt track driver in the Illinois area in the 1930s, but by now he was in Memphis, Tennessee and had a little trucking company. And one day one of his drivers came to him and said, you know, we run dual axles on the trucks and we get very good traction through the mountains with all the twisting turns. What would happen if you had a race car with dual rear axles? And he said, I don't know, let's find out. So they built one. They built the car themselves, and everybody laughed when the thing showed up. It had it was just a dirt track type car, but with tandem rear wheels. They qualified. Ran all day, ran 193 laps, and finished 12th. So, in summary, DeVore had great finishes because he had the 7th with Fred Frame in 37. He was 8th in 38, 10th with Henry Banks, relieving in 39. And then he had those other finishes of 18th and 19th and 40 and 41. 46, he was 10th. 47th, he was 10th as a relief driver for Duke Dinsmore. And 1948, he was 12th. So good average position. He just never ran at the front, but he always brought him home. And also, he was very... We mentioned earlier the accident at Atlanta, Georgia, that took the life of George Barringer and George Robson. Billy DeVore was very definitely involved in that one. And, in fact, his car got upside down in the lake, which had all kinds of slime and everything, and he had a great sense of humor. And whether he actually said this or not, nobody really knows. But he is reputed to have said that the car got upside down. He's reputed to have climbed out of the lake, covered with not seaweed, but all slime and stuff like that. And the first person went up to him and said, are you all right? And he said to the person, Dr. Livingston, I presume? I don't know whether that's true or not. Anyway, after he was no longer driving, he worked for Firestone Tire and Rubber Company for quite a number of years, and then he was involved with the tire testing program as an observer, and he just loved the Speedway. He could be a little cantankerous, but he just loved the Speedway. Anyway, we ran on just a little bit here. Dave, Len, hang on. 239-1070 is number to call. We'll be back with more on the Talk of Gasoline Alley, 1070 The Fan. We've got about 15 minutes left on this segment of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. At 7 o'clock, we go to the Network Indiana version. And then at 8 o'clock here on 1070 The Fan, Mike King and Indy Live. And I don't know who the guests are tonight, but they usually have a bunch of people. So there'll be plenty of motorsports on the air this evening. Let's go to the phones. And Dave, you're up. Good evening.
Good evening, Donald. I really enjoyed your talking about Larry Cannon. Grew up in Vermilion County, Illinois, and Larry used to cut my hair way back when.
Oh, yes. I didn't mention that. In fact, his brother Steve also cut hair there, and so did Bubby Jones.
And actually, yeah, I think Bubby raced at the Speedway, and I know that some of Larry's pit crew were also barbers. But anyway, I wanted to talk to you about my dad was around the Speedway back in the early and mid-1950s and had a acquaintance who drove, and I think was actually Rookie of the Year early on, Jimmy Daywalt. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Jimmy Daywalt.
Okay, sure. Yeah, Jimmy Daywalt was from Wabash, Indiana, and he had quite a long career, as they were then, at the Speedway. Because actually, he was entered from 19... 49 until 1963. Now, he wasn't in the race every year. In fact, it was his fifth year before he made it the first time. But he was a very interesting guy because I think he was in an ice show, he was in several ice shows. He was a very accomplished skater, and he caught the tail end of World War II as in the ferry command. And Jimmy DeWalt, if you met him, I mean, he was not somebody that you would imagine to be in the military, but he actually shuttled planes during World War II, just caught the tail end of that. I think ferrying bombers from peaceful areas into next to the, you know, not so peaceful areas. Anyway, he at one point, I mean, he liked racing, but at one point apparently he had to decide whether he was going to be a race driver or perform as a skater, because he was good enough that he could participate in shows. Anyway, so he chose driving. And right after the war, with the Central States Racing Association, CSRA, I think it was 1948, he was second, driving for Franklin Merkler from Fort Wayne, and Merkler ended up buying an Indianapolis car for him, but that'll come in a few moments. His first year, I won't do all the car names, but I love some of these car names. In 49 was his first shot at Indianapolis, and I think this would only be like his third or fourth season of racing, so he got there in a hurry, and he drove for Steve Trushin, and the car was Bill and Bud's Motor Sales Special, which was a used car dealer, and they don't have sponsors like that anymore. Anyway, he passed his rookie test, but the car didn't run fast enough to even warrant making a qualifying attempt. In 50, he drove in practice for the Iddings brothers, and in 51, he had the Merkler Machine Works Special, as he did in 52, and this was the former Bosio Fast Special. This was the one that Rex Mays had qualified for the pole in 1948. Anyway, Jimmy went through 51 and 52, still hadn't made a qualifying attempt, and then in 53 actually was not one of the original entered drivers, but he was in the Engel and Stanko special, and then the chance of a lifetime opened up for him. There was a new team had been put together with Chapman Root, whose grandfather designed the Coca-Cola bottle, and Don Smith, who was a relative of Tony Holman. In fact, his father and Tony were first cousins. Anyway, they put together a team that ran the Sumar Specials, and Sumar was actually a name made up of their wives for Susan and Mary, and that's where the S and the U and the M and the A and the R come from to make Sumar. The first year that they entered was 1953, and Gene Force was to be their driver. And he got injured in a sprint car, I think at Fort Wayne. But anyway, just before the track opened, he got injured so he couldn't compete. Jimmy Jackson was in it for a while, and then eventually they tried Jimmy DeWalt, and a marriage was made. And DeWalt ended up finishing sixth, and he was the second Rookie of the Year, Stock of Wetzel in those days. We'll hurry it along a little bit now. They got a new Curtis for 1954. He qualified in the middle of the front row and actually led eight laps, and just past the halfway, he got tangled up with Jim Rathman, had been relieved by Pat Flaherty, and Pat hadn't been running long before he and DeWalt got together, so that knocked them both out. Then in 55, they had the Sumar Special that came with a fully enclosed streamlined body and a canopy, and they took the canopy off because there was problems with static electricity gathering the dirt and oil, and then he apparently was not comfortable in not being able to see the wheels touch the line in the turn, so they eventually removed the bodywork, and the more streamlining they took off, the faster it would go. It ran in the race with no streamlining at all, and he finished ninth. In 56, he hit the wall and was injured, and then all of those were the Sumar Specials. In 57, he drove for Herb and Elsie Johnson with the Helsey Special, and and spun out in that one. In 59 with the Federal Engineering Detroit Special, he was the third fastest qualifier, but not on the front row because he qualified in the back. He ran all day, finished 14th, and then in 60 he qualified the Bryant Heating and Cooling Special, but when they ran it in the final practice run, the so-called carburation run, some changes had been made, and he didn't feel comfortable with the car, and so he elected not to drive it, and they put Dempsey Wilson in. So it looked like that he had actually effectively retired. Well, he hadn't, because he was back in 61 with the Schultz Fueling Equipment Company Special and finished 31st, and then in 62 for Tassie Vettis with the City of Albany, New York Special, and finished 22nd, and then 63, he was in Joe Hunt's car, the Winds Friction Proofing Special, incomplete attempt, I think either one or two, and then put Chuck Rohde in the thing for the last shot, and that was Jimmy's last year. He won several sprints. He was a good sprint car driver, AAA sprints, and I think he won at Salem. I think he won like two or three races in 1950 and was fourth in the Midwest Sprint Car Championship, and eventually he was a truck driver, and he was stricken driving to the West Coast in early 1966, or I think it was March of 66, or maybe early April, and he got taken ill, brought back, put in hospital, and I went to see him in the hospital, and he was yellow. He looked like he had jaundice, but he actually had a kidney disease and failure, and he passed away, I think it was April the 24th of 1966. There, just very quickly, there was, I don't know if it's still there, there was a DeWalt pharmacy in Wabash, and that was Jimmy's brother. Anyway, we thank you, Dave, for calling. Ran over a little bit. Len, Brad, hang on. We'll be back with more of the Talk of Gasoline Alley right after this. We've got about 5 minutes left in this hour of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. When we come back after 7 o'clock, it will be the Network Indiana version, and we'll give you a different phone number at that time when we come back. And then when we're done at 8 o'clock, then it will be Indy Live with Mike King and guests. You'll have to be surprised. I just know they always have a lot of outstanding guests. All right, back to the phones. Len, thank you for hanging on.
Yes, sir, Donald. Thank you for taking my call, and really enjoy your show. It's much of May as anything.
Well, thank you very much.
And you were talking about Larry Cannon a little earlier. That was 1966 when he won the Eldora 500.
Oh, all right, then. Really? Okay.
Yeah. I kind of remember that very well. I was wanting to ask about one of my favorite drivers.
Oh, you're Len,
Don Branson.
You're Len that finished fourth or fifth?
Fourth, yeah.
Are you you're that Len?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
that's why I remember it.
Okay, then.
I wanted to ask about Don Branson. That was one of my favorite drivers, and Pete DiPaolo, and then I'll hang up and listen. And thanks again.
Okay, then. I get Don Branson. I think I get a call on him every year. And it gives me a chance to show off and say that he lived in Champaign, Illinois, and his address was 29 Howard Street. And I don't know why that sticks with me, but that is just carved in granite. Don Branson was an IMC. He actually blossomed in USAC a lot later than most. He ran IMCA for several years, and I think 52, 53, 54, he would run like fourth or fifth in points. He was never in the top three, but always well above the 10th spot. And then 55, he actually ran some AAA a little bit, not championship, but some he dabbled with midgets and sprints. And in fact, Don Branson won the last AAA race ever held, which was an indoor event at Fort Wayne in what was then the Allen County Memorial Coliseum, on like December the 27th or 28th or something like that. Anyway, just very quickly, his 500 starts were from 59 through 66. The best finish was fourth in 60 for Bob Estes. In 61, he was in the middle of the front row with the Hoover Motor Express Special and went two laps. There was something hadn't been put in correctly, and so he was very embarrassed to come down and had the inside flank and the outside flank going by him on both sides, and so he was obliged to retire very quickly. Then in 62, driving for Lindsay Hopkins, the Mid-Continent Security Special, got delayed along the way and finished 12th. At 63, he was running 4th very late in the race, had to make a pit stop to change a right rear with about 6 laps to go, and it dropped him to 5th. And then 64 was his first run with a rear engine car. He did not like rear engine cars, but he had a third place going late in the race. It was Voigt was leading with the front engine car, and then Roger Ward was second, and Don Branson was Ward's teammate by then, leader car team, except that Ward had A.J. Watson and Branson had Judd Phillips, and they were running third, and the clutch went out, and he struggled along and then finally had to pack up after 187 laps and dropped to 12th. And then in 65 with a new Watson, he finished 8th and was battling with Bobby Johns with the Lotus, the teammates of Clark's, and that was a close finish. Somebody asked me the other night about close finishes between lesser positions, and I remember those two came along just a car length apart with Johns beating Branson out for seventh place. And then the last start was 66 when he came down for the start and was involved in the first lap accident. So I just got a few moments, so I'm going to kind of have to hop along here. He won, let's see, 5 championship races. I think he won 2 in 62. And then, and a footnote in history was that he was the last person to win a championship race with a Roadster, which was the Phoenix 150, which opened the 1965 season, which he did with a Watson Roadster. He also won Springfield in 66, and he won the Sacramento 100, which was the... No, he was on the pole at Sacramento, and Dick Atkins won. That's what it was. And then the two of them both lost their lives in the final sprint race of the year at Ascot Park Speedway. Anyway, we're going to have to wrap this hour up. And, Brad, I'm sorry we didn't get with you. If you want to hang on, maybe we can work it out that you come on to the Network Indiana show, which will be the one that follows this. And then at 8 o'clock once again, it will be Mike King here with Indy Live. Anyway, we're going to wrap this one up. We'll be back on the other side of the hour with more of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. That one will be on Network Indiana. Talk to you in a few minutes. We have got Brad, who's been hanging on very patiently from the previous program. And so, Brad, we better give you the number. We've got a couple of people hanging on. But the number to call is 1-800-603-6453. 1-800-603-6453. And, Brad, thanks for hanging on. What would you like to hear about? Hello, Brad? All right, there may be, if there was a problem. Yes, Brad?
Yes, Donald, you there?
Yes, thanks for hanging on.
Okay, sir. Well, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to echo the sentiments of so many of your listeners. What a delight it is listening to you recollect the races over the years and the different drivers. It's just it's very enjoyable.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome. I had the privilege of working for Leroy and Faye Warner and Gene Hartley back in the early 70s for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And very, very wonderful people. And I know that Gene made a number of 500s. However, Leroy, although he was a national sprint champion and went to Australia and all that, I don't believe he made any of the grids for the 500. I was always curious as to why that was and if you could shed some light on that.
Okay. I don't know the answer, but he did try a number of times. Actually, as early as 1949, he was on the track. And it was the national midget champion rather, not sprint. 1953, he was Triple A's midget champ. But he did do very well in sprints, actually, which he's normally associated with midget cars only. But he had some excellent runs with sprints. He never won a feature, but he did have some seconds and thirds on the high banks like Winchester and Fort Wayne. Anyway, as far as Indianapolis was concerned, and the end result of this is going to be, it's one of those people where your heart bled for him because he wanted it so much. He was from here, and he tried so many times, and it would have been great if he could have just made it. Even if he just made it once, he would have been in the 500. Anyway, in 49, he took part of a test in the Lutz Truck Part Special, and then in 1950 he was briefly with the two Maseratis that, or at least one of them, had been Mike Boyles, and a team was formed in 1949 called IRC, Indianapolis Race Cars Incorporated, and two Maseratis came under the same roof with a bunch of car owners. There was about 8 or 10 partners in on this. They called it a syndicate then, which unfortunately is a term that came to mean something else a little bit later. But they were mostly Indianapolis bankers, all rival bankers and financiers bought this equipment and ran this team. Anyway, Leroy was briefly on that team in 50. And then in 51, the Heller Special, owned by George Heller. And he didn't make a qualifying attempt with that one. He did actually pass the rookie test, by the way. Then in 52, it looked like a really good shot. He and Johnny Tolan, who were very, very good friends, Tolan was from Denver. He ended up winning the 52 Midget Championship, and then Leroy succeeded him in 53. Anyway, they were together on the Earl Slick's Blue Crown Spark Plug Specials, which actually were Lou Moore's cars that Maury Rose and Bill Holland had finished first and second with in 47 and 48, and then Holland won in 49. Anyway, after the 50 race, Lou Moore put the cars up for sale, and they were purchased by Bill Anstead Rotary in 51, and then in 52 they were sold to Earl Slick, who I think was from San Antonio, Texas. Anyway, Leroy Warner and Johnny Tolan were the drivers, and we thought, right, this is the hot setup. And neither one of them were able to get the cars up to speed, and both were taken out and replaced by other drivers, and Tony Bettenhausen qualified with one of them. Anyway, 53, he was in the Jim Robbins Special, which was the Johnny Parsons winner from 50 in the rain, and also the runner-up in 49, and then runner-up again in 51 with Mike Nazarick driving, and Leroy couldn't get that one going either. Then in 54, an outfit called 3L Racing Team, which was the forerunner of Racing Associates, and a couple of the owners, Nelson and Sylvester Johnson, and Art Lathrop, who had been partners in the IRC team that I mentioned a few minutes ago, they got Tom Binford to sponsor it. It was the DA Lubricant Special, and everything was looking great. And he got hurt at Fort Wayne just before the track opened. I'm not sure if it might have been like May the 1st or something like that, but he broke his arm. And so had to miss the whole month of May. And then in 55, he drove for Bill Anstead and had a problem. Len Duncan in the McNamara Roadster spun, and Leroy came on the scene with the Anstead Rotary and then spun, and apparently had run a yellow light, and so he was reprimanded, and I think the fine was like $25 or something. Then in 56 he drove for Roy McKay with the McKay's Bulldog, didn't make a qualifying attempt, but in 57 he made two qualifying attempts and he wasn't quite there. And so he was taken out, and they put Don Edmonds in for the final run, and Don Edmonds made it. So then Leroy had one final shot, and that was in 1958 with the former Jones and Maley Special that we talk about every year as the Safety Autoglass Special. And that is the car that it ended up on the roof at the Safety Autoglass building on Southeastern Avenue, and it's there to this day. It's still there. Anyway, that was Leroy's last shot, and he didn't make a qualifying attempt with that one either. But, yeah, he was a great storyteller, won a lot of midget races, and a horrendous practical joker.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, that's some stuff that no one could ever find out unless you're the one to talk about it. So I thank you very much for that information, Don.
All right, well, thank you. And in fact, I'll tell you what, he had one championship start. He had several attempts at qualifying for championship race. He made one, and it was the 1953 Hoosier 100, and they took the fastest 18 qualifiers. They'd have like 35 cars trying to qualify, the fastest 18, and he made it. He got the 18th spot, and he was the first one out. So he did have championship start. That was the 53 Hoosier 100. Anyway, Brad, thanks for calling, and thanks for hanging on. So Rhea from Dayton, Ohio, you hang on. We'll just take care of some business here, and in a couple of minutes, we'll be back and get to you. You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. Okay, we're back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and just a quick note on Leroy Warren. I'm going to insert myself in this one a little bit. When he passed away, Faye, his wife, asked me if I would do the eulogy, and I said, oh, come on, you know, you need to get the other races to do it. But anyway, so we went to the calling, and the line was all the way out the door, and she was standing at the head of the line in her stocking feet, and there was laughter and peals of laughter for coming from all the different rooms, and the line just was, as I say, was all the way out the door. And when we came back the next day, a lot of people got there early, and they're all standing around in groups and laughing, and the ushers were trying to get everybody settled down and seated. And I've never been to a funeral that was quite like that, which is exactly what he would have wanted. And it took forever to get the ushers to be able to quieten everybody down. Everybody was having such a good time. I never saw anything like it. And then when the thing was over, there was applause, and you know, nobody wanted to go home. That's exactly what Leroy would have wanted. Anyway, Rhea, you've been hanging on from Dayton, Ohio for quite some time. How are you this evening, and what would you like to hear about?
I'm fine. Quick comment. I really enjoyed the call from Mark, I think, the other Sunday night about the blind man, about riding in the two-seater.
I wondered if you were listening to that.
I was, and I loved it. I'm going to have to do that sometime.
Okay.
Get over there and somehow do it. You don't have much of a British accent anymore, but you do. You give yourself away with bean sometimes.
Oh.
And then, is pouring with rain a English colloquialism? I've never heard that from anyone.
Pouring with rain? You've never heard that?
No, not from.
Oh.
No, not pouring with rain.
Oh, okay.
I've never heard that. I believe I heard you reference a driver who's by the first name of Mac the other night, and since my guide dog is Mac.
Oh, Mac Hellings.
Could you talk about him?
Sure. I assume that's who you mean. In fact, it would have been in reference to George Tufanelli, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Mac Hellings was born in Fort Dodge, Iowa, and was taken to California when he was quite young, and that's what happened with most of the California drivers. They weren't born there, but they were taken there when they were like 3-4 years old. Anyway, he went to, let's see, was it Hollywood High or Fairfax High? Anyway, it was. He pretty much lived in Burbank, and he was a he was involved in motorcycle racing. In fact, I never even thought about the fact when somebody was asking the other night about all the different people that have been at Indianapolis that have motorcycle involvement. I was overlooking Mac Hellings. One thing I have never known, and I would like to know, I don't know that his name was, that his given name was Mac. I don't know if it's short for McDonald or something like that, or whether he was, in fact, christened Mac. I've never known that, and I would like to. Anyway, at the Speedway, 1948 was his first year, and Lou Moore. This was the second year for the Blue Crown Specials, and Maury Rose and Bill Holland, the 1-2 finishers of 47, were back with the front drives again. And a third car had been ordered because they wanted Bill Holland to go for the national championship. Maury Rose was only running the 500. That would be the only race he was running per year by now. But Bill Holland, they wanted to go for the championship, and you couldn't do it with the front drive. So they ordered what they called the Baby Blue Crown, which was a smaller Blue Crown that had wire wheels. And anyway, Mac Hellings was the entered driver, and he passed the test, but he couldn't get the thing up to speed, and it's just... It was always interesting how different car driver combinations would not work out, but a different combination would. And sometimes drivers swapping rides and making it, whereas they could not with the with the original assignment. Anyway, there was a car called, there was a Curtis 4000, I think. It was a dirt track type car, the Don Lee Special. And Mack Hellings got in that, and in very few laps he was running fast and qualified on a later day and ended up fifth, and that was his rookie year. Then in 49, he drove49 he drove for Don Lee again and dropped out late and finished 16th. Then 50, he drove for George Tuffinelli with the Tuffy's Offie. And that was the race which stopped at 345 miles because of rain, and he was 13th. And then in 51, he drove an Emmy Odette car that was based on the Blue Crowns and also on the Howard Keck Special that showed up in 48. This was called the Tuffinelli and DiRico Special. George Tuffinelli and Jimmy DiRico from Chicago. Anyway, Mack qualified for them, and that was a disappointing run, and he only ran, I think, like 14 laps or something, and was 31st. That turned out to be his last 500. He went down in a plane crash. It was, I think he was flying to the championship race at Bay Meadows. But it wouldn't have been a championship. Oh, yes, they did run a championship race at Bay Meadows in 51 that Tony Bettnausen won. And I think he was flying to that or coming home from it. And the plane went down and was missing, I think, for like a day or two before they found it. And he went down with another driver named Bobby Barker, who had won a sprint. It was a West Coaster, but he won a sprint race at Reading, Pennsylvania. And see, something else I was... Oh, yeah, Mack Hellings had some excellent runs on dirt. He never won a championship race, but he had some seconds. And in 1949, we mentioned earlier the Pat Clancy six-wheeler. In 49, he went to Trenton, New Jersey, which at that time was a one-mile dirt track, and he was running third and crashed in the last lap, flipped end over end. In fact, I think that might have been the end of the six-wheeler. I'm not sure, because it did get converted to a four-wheeler shortly after that. But anyway, Mack Hellings is somebody that I'd like to know more about, and I don't know that I'll ever have that opportunity, but you never know, because these things just sometimes tend to drop in your lap. Anyway, Rhea, thank you very much indeed for the call. Ray, Jay, and Mike, you hang on. We'll be back and do another half hour here in just a few moments. If you'd like to get on the end of the line here, the number to call is 1-800-603-6453. It's 1-800-603-6453. And a thanks. We didn't do it in this hour. We'd like to thank Dennis Reinbold and Robbie Buell, who are the principals of the Brian Reinbold Racing Team, for allowing us to set up in their garage. I think everybody's gone but one person now, but it was a hype of activity here about an hour or so ago with all of the drivers. Buddy Rice, Milk Oduno, and Townsend Bell were all sitting with the engineers and doing the debriefing. Anyway, we've got a half hour to go when we come back, but we do have to take care of some business right now, so you hang with us, and we'll be back with more of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana right after this. Just under a half hour left of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We will be back tomorrow night from 7 till 8. There will be no show over the weekend, and then we'll be back on Monday through Friday from 7 till 8. And we go to the phones, and Ray from Cleveland. Are you a first-time caller?
What? No.
Oh, you have called before. Okay.
Yes.
I didn't remember a Cleveland call before.
a long time ago.
Okay.
Now, I have a question about Harry Miller, Donald, but first, let me preface it with this. Now, what was the last year an Offenhauser-powered car ran at the Speedway?
In the race was 1980 with Billy Vukovich, finished 12th. Yeah,
okay.
But they were at the track after that, but that's the last one to qualify.
Okay, well, I truly marvel that Harry Miller created an engine block that of course it was changed over the years, but it was basically the same block that ran from the 20s all the way up to 1980, 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
And 60 years worth of running at the speedway, and they were turbocharging them toward the end, 78 pounds of boost compared to only 6 pounds of in a street car. Just phenomenal things that they were doing to that engine. I've never seen anything like that as far as engine design. So I'm wondering if you could give us a thumbnail sketch of Harry Miller and that, how he developed that engine, and how much was Harry Miller, and how much was Fred Offenhauser, and even Leo Goosen, the brilliant designer and draftsman.
Yeah. Leo Goosen's the man. Harry Miller was, they say he was a genius. He could apparently see these concepts in his mind, but he didn't know how to put them on paper. That's what Leo Goosen did. And he was not a businessman. Fred Offenhauser was. Fred Offenhauser was an engineer. And so, that's the simple version. There's one thing, though, that we probably need to clarify. The original, the successful Miller in the 20s was a straight eight, and it was the four that became the Offie, and that started, the first one at the track was in 1930. They called it the Miller Marine engine. It was a four-cylinder version of the eight. How it would differ, I don't know, because I am not a gearhead, but it was the first Miller 4 in 1930, and Shorty Cantlin finished second, and that's the one that became the Offie. And in 1934 is when they started to call the engines Offenhausers, because Harry Miller had... I don't remember if he went bankrupt, but he was about to, and Fred Offenhauser was able to take over the company. But all that time, all the way through the years, Leo Goosen was there. And there's something that is really fascinating about Fred Offenhauser and Leo Goosen. I don't know that Fred Offenhauser ever came to the track until after he'd sold the company, long after he'd sold the company to Louis Meyer and Dale Drake. So, which was 1945 or 46, I've never seen a date on that. But even on into the 60s, I just know that he was here one time after he was retired. I don't think that Fred Offenhauser came here all the time that he was running the company. And then the other one, too, is Leo Goosen. I'm not sure that Leo Goosen ever came to the Speedway, and he was with the company through every phase for decades. But about Harry Miller, he was a perfectionist, but he was not a businessman, and somebody told me that they would have like a camshaft that had they'd been grinding and maybe had 100 hours in it, and there would be something about it that he wouldn't like, and so he would scrap it and have them start over again. So even although he was selling cars left, right, and center, because they started off with the engine, the first Miller engine, actually, this was, nobody was too happy about this one. Jimmy Murphy, who was a really nice guy, bought a Duesenberg. The car that he won the French Grand Prix with in 1921, he bought that car from the Duesenberg brothers, and they were struggling financially as well, and had other people running the company that bore their name. And so when Jimmy Murphy purchased the car, they figured, well, that's great, because it's going to do wonders for the Duesenberg automobile company, because every time he wins, then that's going to translate into sales for Duesenbergs. And what he did was to, with no malice of any kind, he wanted to win the race, and what he did was remove the Duesenberg and put a straight 8 Miller in it. So the first Duesenberg victory and the first Miller victory was actually the same car. And Duesenberg's apparently weren't very happy about it. But anyway, that engine then, it wasn't long before Harry Miller was building complete cars. And by the time you get to 25, 26, virtually the entire field was Miller's for a few years there, including the front drive, which was also a Jimmy Murphy Jimmy Murphy concept. In fact, that first front drive car that finished second in 1925 was actually commissioned by Jimmy Murphy, but as was the way in those days, drivers did not live long lives, and he was fatally injured before the car could be completed. But anyway, Harry Miller was, who did come to the track, by the way, Fred Offenhauser and Leo Goosen didn't. Everything that you read about him, he was just called a genius. There are several books, so if you want to read up on him, that's easily done. All right, we do need to take a break coming up here. So Jay from St. Paul and Mike from Vernon Hills, Illinois, we're getting national calls now. You two fellows hang on, and we'll be back with you. We'll give you the number if somebody wants to try and tag on at the end. It is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We got about just over a quarter of an hour left on the Talk of Gasoline Alley for tonight, and we got several callers hanging on. So, Jay in St. Paul, good evening.
Good evening, Donald.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, great to be back again. 1911, there was a driver, Will Jones.
Yes.
Did he have what I would consider to be the probably the only paint job in the race? He had, like, shark teeth on the car?
Oh, I think that was on the... There were three Case automobiles, and I think they were all painted up like that for the race.
Oh, okay.
I believe so. That they were Case built passenger cars. In fact, those were stripped down passenger cars, and it was the J.I. Case Threshing Machine Company from Racine, Wisconsin, where Paul calls from. And Will Jones and Joe Jagersberger and Louis Strang were in the cases, and I think they were all painted up like that for the race.
Okay. Then could you talk about Jim Davies?
Jimmy Davies, sure. Yeah, Jimmy Davies was... well, I'll give you the record first, and I'll tell you some stuff about him that was pretty amazing. I better do his upbringing first. It turns out that drivers would tend to... lie about their age so that they could get into racing earlier than they should have. He actually lied by 4 years, and his date of birth was believed to be August the 8th, 1925. He was actually August the 8th, 1929, and that was backed up by several people. In fact, a guy called me one time about 10 years ago, and he said, if you've ever wondered about Jimmy Davies' age, I can tell you exactly, because he said, I grew up with him, and I went to school with him, and he lived on our street. And so anyway, Davies got started very early in racing, but it's his upbringing that is just truly amazing. So let's just do the career, and then I'll go back and tell you something that would just shows you how different it is now. He started racing hot rods right after the war, in California, along with Dick and Jim Rathman, Pat Flaherty, Troy Ruttman, Don Freeland, Andy Linden, Dempsey Wilson, on and on and on. He was part of that group, and he developed very quickly, as they all did, and in 1949, he won a championship race at Del Mar, and the race that Rex Mays lost his life in November the 6th, 1949 at Del Mar. Jimmy Davies won that race, and he wasn't 21 yet. Anyway, he came to Indianapolis in 50 with Pat Clancy, who we mentioned. Pat Clancy was the man who'd had the six-wheeler, and the first Davies' first ride actually was the six-wheeler converted to a four, and that's what he was driving when he won at Del Mar and came to the Speedway with that car in 1950. And was 21st in the was running at the end or well running at the point where the race got stopped because of rain. In 51, he drove for a man named L. E. Parks, who was from somewhere down in Mississippi. The Parks Motor Company special, and the car was built by Johnny Paul. And he actually led some laps with that. In 52, he wasn't at the Speedway because he was doing military duty and was stationed in, I think he went to Korea. It was Jerry Hoyt went to Germany, Jimmy Davies went to Korea. Anyway, back in he was back in time to run in the 1950 race, and he started off with Merle Bellinger, the Miracle Power Special, with George Salyer's mechanic. That combo wasn't working out, so he switched and went back to Pat Clancy, who now had a Roadster, and finished 10th. He got bumped in 54, but he was a relief driver for... he was part of this footnote. The most number of drivers to drive the same car in the same race, 5. Art Cross started the Bardell Special. He was relieved by Johnny Parsons, then relieved by Sam Hanks, then Andy Linden, and finally it was Jimmy Davies that brought it home in 11th place. And then in 1955, Jimmy Davies drove the Pat Clancy car that he finished 10th with in 1953. It was now the Bardell Special, and he finished 3rd. Now, Davies actually was at the Speedway several years after that, but he never again qualified. He was the USAC Midget Champion 3 years in a row, 60, 61, and 62. And anyway, there's a couple of things to know about him, and just shows you how different it was. He came from very, very humble beginnings. His mother divorced and remarried. The stepfather was a ruled with an iron hand, and he used to beat Jimmy. And according to this neighbor, beat him with a pipe, and he ran away at like 12, and he never came back. He made his own way in the world from that point on. So the people out there that think they've got it tough, it was amazing what you could do. And he spent the next few years living with men who were older than him by several years. He got into a confrontation one time. They were on a ranch. They used to go out into the desert, way north of Los Angeles. They used to go out into the desert and capture jackasses. And Davies was given a horse one time, or at least he thought that he was the owner of the horse. And there was a dispute over it, and he ended up taking a gun out and shooting the horse, and he was like 13 or 14 years old. Tough customer, raised by his own bootstraps, but he made it as a race driver, and I met him. He wasn't great on social graces, but it was just amazing what you could do. And I was thinking of other Jimmy Davies stories, but anyway, I've kind of used up the time. But anyway, thanks, Jay, for asking about him, and maybe we'll do some more on another night. Mike from Vernon Hills, Illinois, will be next, but we do have to take a break. So, Mike, you hang on. Also, Kevin and Tom, we'll try and get to all of you. You were listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We've just got a few minutes left on the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and I've kind of been telling long stories tonight, and I had another Jimmy Davies story, but I'll save that for another time. Mike from Vernon Hills, Illinois, thanks for hanging on. What would you like to hear about tonight?
Good evening, Donald. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Could you talk about Bill Puterbaugh, please?
Yeah, sure. Puterbaugh ran in 3500, so that'll make it easy. But he actually 68. Is it Roxana, Illinois, I think is where Puterbaugh was from, and he was 3rd in IMCA points in 1966 and came to USAC, and in 68... he drove for the Walther family, the Dayton Steel Foundry Special, and he qualified and got bumped on a really bizarre evening. It was actually darker than it is now on a Sunday where they had a lot of rain, and they decided to extend qualifications beyond 6 o'clock. And I don't know why they did that, but anyway, it was after 6 o'clock on the last day, and they were trying to fill the field in any way that they could. So, anyway, that was Puterbaugh's shot. He did the four laps, earned a spot, but got bumped. Anyway, just suffice to say that he struggled for the next few years trying to make it. In sprint cars in 1969, he was 3rd. He won a race at Syracuse. Those were the days when Larry Dixon and Gary Bettenhausen were swapping the sprint car championship back and forth and finishing first and second to each other. And in 69, with Bettenhausen winning it and Dixon second, Puterbaugh was 3rd. Anyway, Pewterball finally made his first start in 1975, driving for Lee Elkins. It was a Patrick Eagle, and in fact, George Bignotti had the car all prepped up, and when they turned it over to Lee Elkins, they said, look, you don't need to change anything. It's set up ready to qualify. Just, you know, practice with it. Don't bend it. Don't change anything. And when I knew about that, I happened to mention to George, I said, it's really nice that you did that. He said, well, he said, we do that for two reasons. Every time we set up a car, or whenever we sell a car, he said, we set it up like that because, he said, I'm proud of my reputation, and I don't want the word getting around that George Bignotti sold anybody a piece of junk. And he said, and then the other thing is, we like Pewterball. So that was really neat. Anyway, he was the fastest rookie qualifier. I think that was the first year for the American Dairy Association to do the award. I think Pewterball was the first guy to win it. And then in the race was stopped at 174 laps because of rain, and Pewterball was running seventh, and he won the Rookie of the Year with the McNamara DIA Special. And he also drove for Lee Elkins in 76 and 77. There was a bit of a to-do over the 77 run, and I won't get into that, except that the car ended up being called the Dayton Walther Foreman Industry Special, and he finished 12th. There's a story, but we don't have time for that one tonight. And that was Bill was tried a couple of times after that, but that was his three starts. Okay, Mike, I'll tell you what. I would do more on Pewterball, but I'm going to try and get one more call in. We got two people hanging, so Kevin, let's see if we got one that we can handle in a hurry for you.
Hi, Mr. Donaldson. How are you this evening?
I'm just fine. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, thank you. I didn't know if you have met or know of the man. I believe his first name was John Fitch.
Yes.
I believe he's a European sports car driver or Grand Prix driver.
Yes, he's American, actually.
Correct. Okay, very good. And did he run at Indianapolis or have any desire to? Or
yeah, he was here once. Very quickly on John Fitch. In fact, that's somebody I'd like to talk about quite a bit. He lives in Connecticut now. I think he's like 90 years old, but he was born in Indianapolis. And he flew for the British Air Force, although he's an American, and he drove for the Mercedes team. He did not drive any Grand Prix for Mercedes. He had a Grand Prix start for... he drove Stirling Moss's Maserati at Aintree for the British Grand Prix in 1955 and finished ninth. How's that? Anyway, he shared a win with Moss for Mercedes-Benz. It was the Isle of Man TT at Dundrod. And I'll have to hurry along here. John Fitch is the man who developed a lot of safety features that you see on the highways. When you're going down the freeway and it looks like a bunch of trash cans right by a bridge abutment, the yellow trash cans, John Fitch designed that. Anyway, he did have one shot at Indianapolis, 1953, and he drove the Brown Motor Company Special owned by Verlin Brown of Richmond, Indiana. He made a qualifying attempt in Ray Crawford's Roadster, but was not fast enough, and that was his only shot. And then the final note is that when Pierre Levesque was fatally injured at Le Mans in that terrible disaster, Fitch was the man that was going to take over. That's all we got time for tonight. Thank you for Chris May. Thank you, Scott Johnson. We'll be back tomorrow night with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. Yeah.